Hi, thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Chrissy Mernon, and my guest is John Ortega Jr. He's the chief investigator with the Bexar County Fire Marshal and Emergency Management Office. And I invited him here this morning because we have just had such a rash of fires in the city and the county, and both city and county officials have had news conferences or news releases to remind the citizens about fire safety. So we're going to talk about that. And so thank you for joining us. And tell me about your job, what you do at the Bexar County Fire Marshal's office.
Certainly. Well, I appreciate you having me here, Chrissy. Thank you for having us. And thank you for kind of letting us address a little bit of fire safety. Hopefully the listeners will walk away a little bit with some good information to keep them safe and their families safe in their homes. I've been with the County Fire Marshal's office for 10 years now, and currently I'm assigned as the chief investigator over the Fire Arson and Explosion Investigation Division. And basically I supervise six criminal investigators that specialize in fire investigation and arson and explosive related crime. There's other divisions within the Fire Marshal's office, but that's the one that I'm primarily responsible for.
How do you wind up with the Fire Marshal's office? What's your background as far as firefighting?
Well, most of us that are deputy fire marshals there started off as firefighters, whether as paid firefighters or in a volunteer department, and that was kind of the track that I took. I started off at a pretty young age as a volunteer firefighter out in the county, on the southwest side of the county. And my dad was actually the fire chief there for a while. So
I was wondering what sparked your interest,
yeah,
but it was
right. Yeah, exactly.
Right there.
Exactly. And that we had a fire incident that was intentionally set by a gang member out there, and it caused a lot of damage. And of course, when I was a high school student at the time, we responded out and we helped extinguish the fire, but one thing led to another, and there were some circumstances that happened that kind of eventually that same guy in a roundabout way was kind of responsible for the death of another young man out there that was kind of getting into that lifestyle, and that ultimately piqued my interest in arson investigation. And I said, well, you know, I really love fighting fire. It was great. You know, it's a great experience. But I wanted to kind of try to get on the front side of it. And I felt that by getting into arson investigation as a law enforcement officer, I could kind of prevent the fires from happening. And pretty much everybody, all my friends growing up were on the fire department, had stepbrothers at the time. They're both San Antonio firefighters now. You know, it was kind of a family thing, a friend thing. And to me, it appealed to me because it felt like I was doing something that could in turn keep all the other firefighters safe as well as the rest of the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what got me into arson investigation.
Because you're interested in preventing fires in the first place.
Correct.
Finding out what starts them and then making sure it doesn't happen
again. That it doesn't happen again, or that if we have somebody out there that's setting fires, that we hold that person accountable, you know, to the justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So why do people set fires?
Well, any number of reasons, really. If you look at the national, basically, motivation for setting fires, you come up with about five or six, depending on how you're slicing the pie there. But predominantly, you have motivations that are related to profit. That's always going to be an issue, whether the arsonist is working for somebody who's trying to defraud an insurance company. And that predominantly, when people hear the word arson, a lot of times they right away associate it with insurance fraud. And that's kind of been the connotation that's been associated with the crime of arson throughout the years here in the U.S. And people tend to think, oh, well, insurance companies are the only victims behind, you know, that are impacted by arson, which is not really the case, because of the fact that even if nobody gets hurt, you have the whole community put at risk every time there's an intentionally set fire. From the minute that fire engine rolls out of the fire station and they have to travel on public roadways, could be you or I going out to get a cup of coffee, or, you know, my wife taking the kids to school. If they're not paying attention, now you have that added variable of that fire engine responding to an emergency. Obviously, they're driving with due regard to the motoring public, but they still are putting themselves at risk. And if other drivers aren't paying attention, they could likely be at risk as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that increases kind of the risk level there every time that somebody sets a fire. And then also, as far as the insurance goes, a lot of times the insurance policies are, for the rest of policyholders, are impacted right adversely. They get our policy rates may end up fluctuating or going up mm-hmm. because of the fact that you have an inordinate amount of fires or a massive fire loss. So it's very important from that perspective as well. So profit is always one of the motivators. You also have just kind of excitement-based arson, and a lot of times this is where you have people that have some sort of a psychological need or a compulsion to set fires. A lot of times they're small fires, but they can escalate in intensity. A lot of times they might be grass fires. They might be dumpster fires, trash bin fires, that type of stuff. And depending on what exactly the property is that is burned, it may or may not meet the statutory definition of arson. It may be some kind of a lesser offense in the Texas Penal Code. But at any rate, that a lot of times, unfortunately, what we see is that those types of fire setters, setting a small grass fire gets to be old hat for them, basically. So they tend to kind of graduate up to, you know, more significant fires. And ultimately, we want to catch them before they are setting fire to an occupied building or an occupied residence.
Mm-hmm.
You also have, obviously, we've seen nationally instances where it is related to criminal extremism, and that can be kind of related to domestic terrorism, or it can be related to, you've seen in a lot of these situations where you have major civil unrest, you know, and like when we had nationally in Baltimore a few years back where people are just burning other people's property. Of course, the Los Angeles riots, you know, comes to mind for those of us that still remember that, you know, that, and you have that kind of widespread destruction of other people's property with vandalism and with arson. And finally, kind of the two main ones, we see profit as a motivating factor here in Bexar County. A lot of times that is people thinking that they're going to get away with burning their vehicle for the insurance. And unfortunately, that's a very common occurrence here. What people don't realize is that with vegetation being so dry, it can really take off and kind of spread to nearby fields or brush. And ultimately, you know, it could impact a neighborhood. It could get in the green belt of a subdivision and burn up a couple of houses before we can get out there and get a good stop to it. So you see that, and then you also see the number one main motivation is going to tend to be plain old revenge. So boyfriend is upset with a girlfriend, brother's upset with another brother, and a lot of times they can be pretty tragic and gruesome situations because they'll involve an element of violent criminality as well. So it could be an aggravated assault, it could be a homicide, and it related to the arson, or sometimes you'll have what we also have seen, which is typical of organized criminal activity, where it is crime concealment. In other words, they're setting a fire to conceal another crime, be that a burglary, some sort of a theft of a motor vehicle that was used in the transport of possibly illicit drugs, human trafficking, guns, money, any of that. And once they're done with that vehicle, they'll torch it to try to get away with leaving any type of evidence or anything behind. And that's kind of what we see out here. If you look at the national stats and if you look at the local stats here in Bexar County, they kind of mirror each other.
So the same thing that's going on around the country is going on here. That
for the most part.
Sometimes when there's a fire and it's ruled arson, it's somebody did it because they wanted to profit from insurance. And then the other one is the crime, the revenge, the hatred and the ugliness.
Yeah.
That keeps you. But this time of year, and you've had a real problem with people, it's been so cold, people trying to stay warm. And so that's what, tell me about what's going on now.
So I think we had experienced here over the past week or so, kind of a, you know, I know it gets tossed around a lot, but kind of the perfect storm of factors coming together. You had this real kind of cold, you know, sub-freezing temperatures for 2-3 days at a time, which, you know, we're not really used to dealing with that for that long of a time here, even during the day. And then you also had fireworks season because of New Year's, you know. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm like everybody else. We all like to kind of get out there and, you know, pop off some fireworks when we can. But unfortunately, the improper disposal or the improper use of fireworks leads to a lot of burn injuries and leads to a lot of residential structure fires. So what we see a lot of times is people thinking that the debris that, you know, that has fallen, we call it fallout debris from the aerial fireworks, might get onto somebody else's property and kind of ignite some of the vegetation, and you might start a brush fire that way, or you might have a situation where, which is fairly common, and we actually had a number of these over the past week, where they're discharging fireworks and they think that all the spent fireworks are, you know, they're not smoldering anymore. They'll put those up in a trash can, and the trash can's right by the house, and now you have fire propagating inside the trash can and then kind of extending up the exterior of the house. And unfortunately, if it hits that soffit and gets up into the attic space, then you're at risk of losing the entire house.
And I saw something, you have like 2 minutes to get out of a house. That fire, yes, moves very quickly.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. That's another thing that we try to educate the public on is, and really even firefighters, for firefighter safety. A lot of folks simply don't understand that in your contemporary residence, your house, my house, somebody's apartment, a lot of the everyday products that we take for granted, tables, desks, chairs, they're actually constructed of hydrocarbons. So material, you know, whether they're plastics or polymers or something like that. And really, when you look at what an ignitable liquid is, such as gasoline or any of the kerosene, anything like that, when you get down to its chemical composition, it's a hydrocarbon. So, and I'm not going to get too far off in the weeds here, but you have the same type of chemical composition as ignitable liquids in our everyday objects that we have. Now, our desk countertop here is not just going to erupt into flames, right, because of the different chemical properties that we have. But the problem is that when it gets heated to its ignition temperature and it starts to basically decompose through heat, it will release it releases a lot of heat energy. And so you're absolutely right in that fire is very, very fast. A structural fire is very fast. And the time it reaches to what in the fire service they refer to as flashover, which is basically when you transition from, basically the quote is, when you transition from a fire in a room to a room that's on fire, the if you mm-hmm. see kind of the nuance there, you're not going to survive that point if you're caught in that event inside of a compartment. So the best thing to do is to, like you said, get out of your house as quickly as possible. And if you're able to safely do so, we always recommend shut the door behind you, because that will significantly impede the progress of the fire as it extends out from that room. So that's something that you can do that kind of buys the first arriving firefighters a little bit of time to get there, stretch an attack line, get into the building and put the fire out. And also, if there's other occupants in the house, by shutting that door, you're giving those people a chance to survive as well.
As you were saying that, John, I was thinking about that horrible fire in New York. And I heard, you know, and it was started by a little boy, a 3-year-old boy that had a fascination with fire, liked to play with the stove. And he started the fire. But they said, you know, that the mother made another huge mistake. When she fled, she left the door open, and that allowed the fire to go up. It was a multi-story building.
Multi-story building.
And the stairwell was like a chimney.
Absolutely. And which is particularly tragic when you're talking about buildings that are multiple stories, because we're all taught, hey, when you get out of a building, use the stairwells, because of course the elevator system may fail in a fire, and then that, you know, it turns into a death trap in the elevator. So the best way to get out of a multi-story building is, like you said, using the stairwell. Well, that only works if there's compartmentation of that stairwell, meaning if all the doors are shut to that stairwell. That's why a lot of times when you see our fire inspectors going around And, you know, they have a they take issue with, a lot of times people ask, well, what's the big deal about having a doorstop? And, well, it's a big deal if you're talking about compartmentalizing that stairwell, because you want to make sure that the heat and smoke doesn't get in there, because just like you said, it basically turns into a chimney effect. Now you have, imagine all those people fighting for their lives, basically trying to get down that stairwell, and they're being met by all the superheated gases and smoke that is rising up from the lower levels.
So if she had just closed the door. So that's a good point. You know, and I think in an emergency, I mean, I've never been in a fire, but I think, you know, that I definitely would freak out and, you know, run. I mean, run, just get out. And I don't think that I'd have the common sense like, oh, close the door behind you, because all you're thinking about is fleeing. But if you know beforehand, John said, close the door. You know, close the door, trying to contain the fire.
Right. And obviously that's if you're in a situation where you can safely do that. If the room is on the verge of, you know, just being totally engulfed in flames and you just need to get out, then by all means, just get out. But if you have a fire confined in a corner of that room and you can shut that door, then go ahead and do that if you can safely do that. So, yeah, that's a key lesson. And I think that kind of goes into one of the main things that I wanted to talk about, just like you were talking about, if you know beforehand, it's huge that people develop a fire safety plan at home. And it doesn't matter if you are single and you live in an apartment, or if you've got, you know, the Brady Bunch living at home with you and you know, you got five kids and your wife and, you know, grandma and everybody else. Everybody that is in that house or in that home with you should be on the same page of what's going to happen if and when a fire breaks out. Mm-hmm. And that means that ideally we recommend that if you're in any room, that you have at least two ways to get out. So there's going to be, more than likely, there's going to be the normal way that you get in and out of the room. You might have another way, which is maybe leads to another room, you know, another door or something like that. But then you have your worst case scenario exit. And that may be busting out a window to get yourself out of that room. And if you have to bust out a window, then do that if it's to get yourself out. What we don't like to see is during a fire that is going on that people just start breaking out windows. Because what you're doing in effect is actually giving that fire oxygen. Basically, a fire needs three elements to survive. You need fuel, which is, again, like we talked about, in abundance in any house, because fuel doesn't just mean gasoline or kerosene or alcohol or anything like that. It means the chairs that we're sitting on, the paint that is covering our walls, ceiling fans, sofas, bedding, clothing, towels, television sets, anything and everything that you can think of is good fuel for a fire. It's all a matter of how much heat energy is applied to get that to ignite.
Mm-hmm.
So you need fuel, you need heat, which obviously if you've got a fire going on, you already have that, and you need oxygen. And so anytime that we see somebody just kind of haphazardly busting out windows to a house, it's a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really intensifying the amount of fire and the intensity of the fire within that space. And if there's somebody that's trapped in there, then that's bad news for that person as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm. So what are the things that you recommend to people as far as fire safety to avoid some of these fires, especially in winter?
That's a great question. And I think Fire Marshal Chris Lopez, who's my boss, he kind of had a media advisor earlier this week, and I'd like to echo some of the stuff that he said. Basically, one of the main things that we see folks doing is, for whatever reason, maybe their house is not equipped with central air and heat. Maybe the central air and heat went out, or they have no other good way to heat their home, which is unfortunately a reality in our community, in a lot of places in our community. And they will resort to using a stove or an oven to heat their house. And we can't underscore enough how much of a hazardous practice that is, and we really don't want people using stoves and ovens in that way. Number one, if you have the oven open, and number one, it's a burn hazard. if you slip and fall, then you could potentially get burned pretty seriously. Or if you have small children around, they can be burned pretty seriously.
Because you're leaving the oven door open.
Correct.
And you got
it
cooking.
Absolutely. Yeah. But more commonly, what it can do is it can be, depending on the type of stove that we're talking about and on when it's been serviced, it could turn into a carbon monoxide health hazard. So carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas that is poisonous, and it can kill. And if you have a stove and you're using it in that manner, it can very well, depending on, again, like I said, on how it's been serviced or not, it can produce carbon monoxide gas. And unless you have a carbon monoxide detector in your home, which we recommend that you do have, if you have any type of gas burning appliance, we recommend carbon monoxide detectors. You won't know unless that alert goes off. And if you're sleeping in there, unfortunately, you know, we've made many calls where entire families have perished, and that's always a tragedy because of this toxic gas.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's why we always recommend if you have gas appliances, you want to make sure you get a service technician out there to service them once or twice a year,
mm-hmm.
and make sure if you notice any problems, then you know, call a qualified technician and make that repair.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, they're a huge fire hazard. A lot of folks also use the burners on stoves to heat their residence, and again, that is a practice that we strongly discourage. And the reason for that is that there, again, the abundance of combustible materials in your kitchen, in your home, anything that goes awry, and all of a sudden you have a kitchen fire, and it is spreading throughout the rest of the house, and it could potentially endanger your life,
mm-hmm.
or the lives of the rest of your family members.
Now, what about space heaters? Our guest this morning is John Ortega, Jr. He's the chief investigator with the Bexar County Fire Marshal and Emergency Management Office. So what about space heaters? Because they keep us warm, but they also are a fire hazard.
Yes, they can be. And so you always want to make sure to start off with that you're using a space heater that has been kind of tested by an independent laboratory like UL Labs, and that they have an auto shutoff. And that's very important because in the event that something happens, maybe you fall asleep, you know, in your favorite recliner, and in your sleep you turn over and you kick the space heater over. Well, now it's in contact with maybe a throw or a rug or a carpet or maybe the upholstery of the sofa. And if it doesn't have that automatic shutoff, that tip over protection, it's going to continue to basically, the heating element's going to continue to function, and it can very well cause a fire because it's in such close proximity. So that brings us to another key issue with portable space heaters. You want to make sure that you keep at least 3 feet of clearance around every portable space heater. And that's clearance from yourself, kids, dogs, bedding, clothing, walls, anything and everything that you might think of. Again, another key point that people don't realize is that pretty much 99% of everything that we have in our homes is combustible. And so when we say keep all combustible materials away from space heaters, we don't want people getting the idea that they're like, well, you know, I don't keep any gas cans in my living room. That's not what we mean. We mean everyday normal items that can catch fire and combust.
They're all combustible.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that's a takeaway that we want people to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So you keep those away from the space heaters. If for some reason you need to leave that room, it's just like a stove. You don't want to leave the stove on and leave it unattended. Turn that space heater off, unplug the space heater, and then when you come back, if you want to enjoy the, you know, using the portable space heater again, then by all means plug it in, turn it back on, and use it. But if you're not there, the best bet is to turn it off and disconnect it.
Oh, and I can see people saying, but I want that room nice and warm when I come back in.
Yeah, I know, but it's just...
safety first.
It's safety first. Yeah, that's the main thing, you know. And the other thing that we want to stress is that we would like to recommend to everybody, if you're using an electrical portable space heater, don't use extension cords. Plug them directly into a wall outlet that is good and functioning. And if you have any problems with your electrical, if you notice breakers that are tripping, if you notice any type of problems sparking at the outlets, please, please contact an electrician and have that taken care of, because we don't want it to get to a situation where your electrical system is contributing to the ignition of a fire.
So there's too much demand from the heating source?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, just think about it. You're drawing a lot of current through that space heater to get that heating element. We're talking about heating up a heating element to be able to radiate heat out to an entire room. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of power to do that. And so when you don't plug it directly into the wall outlet, that cord that comes with the space heater is rated for what it needs to carry through that cord. If you plug it into another extension cord, it may or not be rated for that. And so the problem that you have when you plug it into an extension cord is if it's a smaller conductor and it's not designed for that current draw, then you're going to heat it up very quickly and it could potentially cause a fire.
Because it's overheating. And
exactly.
So if you feel them, sometimes they're warm.
Yeah.
That's bad.
That is bad. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that we don't want is we don't want extension cords being run under carpets, because a lot of times the mechanical action, people just walk on them not knowing, and that mechanical action will break down the insulation of the conductor, and now you can have a fire that ignites that way.
John, as you're talking, I'm thinking these are all common things that we do.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely right. And it's just a small kind of mindset change that can end up paying off in the long run. If God forbid that there's a potential fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we also kind of want to stress that as far as fireplaces go, make sure you have a good quality kind of sturdy screen to stop sparks from flying back into your room. Any ashes or debris from the fireplace need to be cool before you put them into what should ideally be, and what we want you to use is a metal container designed for that with a lid, and that should be stored 10 feet from, at a minimum, from your house. You don't want to put that right up close to your exterior wall, so that if something happens, it starts to smolder, it's not going to catch your house on fire. We also want to make sure that people aren't using any type of gasoline, ignitable liquid, lighter fluid, or put any type of cardboard or paper in their fireplaces, because again, that can lead to flying embers, flying brands, or just a flash fire that gets out of control and spreads to the rest of your house. If you do have a fireplace, make sure that you have it serviced and cleaned by a technician before you're using it, because that creosote buildup that gets up in the chimney can cause a chimney fire, which, you know, depending on the construction of your chimney there, can spread to the rest of the house. And make sure that you have a kind of a kid-free zone around the fireplace and around space heaters. We don't want little ones crawling up to them and them tipping over on them, or them getting burned by being in such close proximity to these things.
Mm-hmm.
One more thing, Chrissy, that we'd like to have people know is just the importance of having working smoke detectors in your house. And we recommend that inside every room where people sleep, every bedroom, and outside of every sleeping area in every level of your home. And that can't be overstated, the importance of that. They really do save lives. Need to get out there and test them monthly. Replace the batteries once or twice a year, preferably twice a year, and replace the entire smoke detector after 10 years. That's something most people don't know.
All great advice. Thank you for stopping by this morning. Our guest, John Ortega Jr., he's the chief investigator with the Bexar County Fire Marshal and Emergency Management Office. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.